Welcome to today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available at recordinglibrary.org and on the telephone reader by calling 432-617-5555.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Friday, February 7th. Storm leaves ice accidents. The story was written by Michael Merlo. Temperatures are expected to warm up this weekend to the 60s and 70s, a welcome change from snow and ice that left roads hazardous on both Wednesday and Thursday and shut down schools and some businesses. Odessa Police Department spokesperson Corporal Steve LeSueur said that OPD responded to about 30 weather-related calls Wednesday night, in addition to the 51 other weather-related incidents since snow started falling in Odessa late Tuesday. By Thursday, OPD responded to more than 80 weather-related incidents, including 3 collisions on Interstate 20 and 3 near Billy Hext Road. One of the collisions on Wednesday night involved an 18-wheeler that shut down I-20 until Thursday morning. LeSueur detailed that none of the reported weather-related incidents resulted in fatalities or life-threatening injuries. Gene Powell, the public information officer for the Odessa District at the Texas Department of Transportation, said TxDOT started treating the roads before the storm started, and although weather is projected to get better, he still urges drivers to pay attention. It's still wet enough to hydroplane, he said, and there is always chance for ice. Julie Phillipson, a meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Midland, said that snowfall ranged from about 6 to 8 inches of snow, with some places getting closer to 10 inches in the Midland and Odessa area. The highest amount in the area was a reported 12 inches of snow in Snyder. With the snow melting and temperatures warming up to around 40 degrees Thursday, the next couple of nights are projected to stay cold, Phillipson said, but, quote, by the end of the weekend, we're going to be up in the 60s and 70s again, so the snow will be pretty much all gone by Sunday, end quote. Drivers are advised to take their time if they are on the roads around sunrise or sunset, especially on bridges and overpasses, Phillipson said. Wednesday's snow melt left patches of icy roads on Thursday, and freezing temperatures are projected to create more ice on Midland and Odessa roads. Students in Odessa were treated to the rare snow day. Both Wednesday and Thursday were snow days, and Ector County ISD's website at ectorcountyisd.org featured tweeted photos of students and teachers enjoying the days off and the snow. Chevron contributes to BAAS Degrees Fab Lab. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. Odessa College recently got an infusion of $200,000 donated by Chevron for its instrumentation and automation programs and Fab Lab. Executive Director of Institutional Advancement, Jackie Gore, said the oversized checks were presented January 21st, with $125,000 going to the Instrumentation and Automation Lab and $75,000 to the Fab Lab. Quote, both of these programs were developed here at Odessa College by Chevron from the very beginning, Gore said. About 10 years ago, Chevron leadership took Odessa College President Greg Williams to Waco to tour an instrumentation program there and let Williams know that this was a needed field in the Permian Basin, she said. A few years ago, Chevron leadership wrote a letter to the state in support of Odessa College being able to offer its applied arts and sciences four-year degrees. The BAAS degree at Odessa College in Leadership and Management as two subsets, occupational health and safety and entrepreneurship. Those two programs started in January 2019, and the BAAS in automation started in August 2019. More than 100 students are studying in those courses. Quote, Chevron has been fantastic in working with Odessa College through the years to really point out what is needed to provide a skilled workforce to Chevron and other energy-related businesses, so the students who study instrumentation and now the bachelor's in automation, which started in August of 19, they're really on the cutting edge of oil and gas in this area. Their skill set could be used in other fields as well, Gore said. In the Permian Basin, she said, they can easily find employment with oil and gas companies in instrumentation and automation, quote, because so much in the oil field is becoming automated, end quote. The $125,000 that OC just received, along with the $125,000 that they donated in 2019, are going toward the purchase of instrumentation and automation equipment, Gore said. Quote, Chevron, from a corporate level, has helped open and fund fab labs across the country, and Odessa College was one of their first fab labs to work on. So the $75,000 contribution goes toward the overhead for that program. The Fab Lab at Odessa College is free of charge for students and for the community to come in and use and create things, Gore said. There is a cost for materials, but people may bring their own materials if they want. She added that other contributions have come in from Chevron, and there is a long-standing relationship between the company and the college. Quote, it's not just a contribution that took place this year, but a long-standing relationship with Chevron and such strong engagement, a partnership. They do more than just write a check, Gore said. They are hands-on involved and involved in the programs, giving input on different advisory boards on campus, letting the department heads and deans know this is what employees need to learn. This is what we're doing in the field that has helped the programs become stronger through the years, end quote. Additional instrumentation equipment has been added through Chevron contributions. It also follows for more students to participate in the programs, Gore said. Fab Lab Director Nicholas Harrison said without Chevron's contributions, quote, none of this equipment would be here. They really are the reason this place exists, and it's a really cool place. But it's not just a cool place. We actually have students who come here and make things and sell them, and that's how they actually fund their tuition to pay for the classes, their books. They take the stuff they make here, they sell it at farmers markets, Harrison said. Continuing the quote, we even have an agreement with the campus store where they can sell stuff from the campus store, and they can also sell it online, Harrison added. It makes a huge difference in people's lives, he added. The Fab Lab is completely open to the public. Anyone can come in and use it. You don't have to be a student, Harrison said. Quote, we have business owners in town who actually come in. We have a couple of jewelers who come in, and they design their jewelry on the lasers, he said. People from out of town also check it out. Quote, many of my students in the class we have here, they come to get certified on this equipment. Then they come in and use it when they want, make whatever they want, and they can either make stuff to sell or they can just make gifts, Harrison added. He said it is free to use this equipment, but the lab does charge for materials such as wood or glass. There is also a charge for training. Quote, to take a certification course, The full course where you get certified on all the machines is $150. If you do one course to get certified on one machine, that's just $40, Harrison said. Armin Reschfand, Department Chair of Engineering and Technology at OC, said the machinery they use to train in automation is used by Chevron and other companies. His course can have a maximum of 20 students each year, and it is not offered each semester. The lab the Odessa American toured recently is a practice area for students and has machines that are smaller in scale than the ones students would be using on the job. Reschfand says it gives students flexibility to see what would happen if they made a mistake when sending a command and how it would affect the machines so they won't make the same mistake when they are actually in their job. Here are some Odessa American quick hits. Downtown Street Market and Downtown Odessa Incorporated has scheduled Cupid Market from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday at 619 North Grant Avenue. The City of Odessa Parks Department and Atmos Energy has scheduled Take Me Fishing for all ages from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday at Comanche Trail Pond, 301 West I-20. There will be Kids Angler EDU, door prizes, and games. No fishing license is required. The event is free. For more information, call 368-3548 or email cbranscombe@odessa-tx.gov. Belmont Baptist Church has scheduled a children's Valentine's skate party for K-5 grade students from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday at Skateland Roller Rink, 4140 West University Boulevard. Students may bring Valentine cards to exchange, but it is not required. 6th through 12th grade students are also welcome. For more information, call 332-0248. Odessa College Visual and Performing Arts Department presents the 2020 Young Artists Competition, an event that showcases the talent of young musicians between the ages of 17 to 20 within the West Texas area. Participants will be competing for cash prizes and may qualify for a full tuition scholarship to study music at Odessa College. The competition is open to any musician ages 17 to 20. Whether vocalist or instrumentalist, performing music from classical, jazz, pop, and musical theater genres. Applicants must complete the entry form, including video submission, by 11:59 p.m. Tuesday. Finalists will be chosen to participate in concert at 7 p.m. February 29th at OC Campus in the Jack Rogers Auditorium. Prize winners will be announced. Go online to apply at odessa.edu/music. Museum receives $5 million donation. The Museum of the Big Bend has received a $5 million contribution from the McCoy family to its museum capital campaign. When completed, construction of a new museum complex will nearly double the size of the existing facility and better enable the museum to serve the entire Big Bend community. The donation from the McCoys increased total donations to the campaign to $7.5 million of the $10 million goal to complete the museum expansion. Quote, I am so excited for our family to be part of this very important expansion of the Museum of the Big Bend, said Miriam McCoy. Continuing the quote, my late husband Emmett would be so pleased about this project, end quote. Sul Ross State University President Bill Kibler said, quote, with the largest donation in the history of Sol Ross State University. Miriam McCoy and the McCoy family have again shown enduring support for the Museum of the Big Bend. This donation allows expanded facilities, displays, and programming, and creates a lasting legacy for the university that further enhances quality of life in the Big Bend. End quote. Museum of the Big Bend's director, Mary Bones, said, quote, "The idea for the museum expansion was first brought forth by board member John M. Marty Davis, who passed away last December. Marty saw the museum as a great educational and economic benefit for the entire region. With enthusiastic support from the museum's board and our contributors, Marty's idea will now become a reality." End quote. The heart of the expansion, a new building adjacent to the existing museum, will be the premier venue for exhibits, meetings, and performances in the Big Bend. The space will showcase both historic and present-day art inspired by the Big Bend and have state-of-the-art collections and curation facilities to protect the museum's valuable art and artifacts. In 2005, Emmett McCoy recognized the architectural significance of the original museum building and its unique roof. With significant support from the McCoy family, a funding campaign restored the building. In 2007, when the Museum of the Big Bend moved into its current location, the building was named in honor of the McCoys. Quote, "We are excited to work with the McCoy family to expand and enhance the Museum of the Big Bend," said Judy Alton, who chairs the Museum of the Big Bend Directors Advisory Council. Quote, "Mrs. McCoy's generous gift has now made it possible for us to create a unique museum experience," end quote. In 1927, Frank McCoy moved his family and a small contract roofing business from Houston to Galveston, Texas, and the McCoy Roofing Company was born. In the 1940s, Frank's son, Emmett, took an active interest in the family business with a vision of selling roofing and other building materials directly to the general public, and McCoy's entered the retail business with the McCoy Supply Company. When Frank retired in 1950, Emmett became president of both McCoy Roofing and McCoy Supply. He promptly expanded the product mix at McCoy Supply Company and opened a second store near Texas City, Texas, in 1960. The company would later become known as McCoy's Building Supply. McCoy's currently operates 88 retail stores across Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Mississippi. The family also operates McCoy Rem Ranches in Jeff Davis, Reeves, and Pecos counties. This is an editorial that was reprinted from the Austin American-Statesman. Tech-savvy Texas should have online voter registration. The point: not only would an online voter registration system be more convenient, it would also translate into significant savings. Over the years, Governor Greg Abbott has bragged that Texas is the new tech mecca, a land of innovators, flourishing startups, and tech giants that power an economy of the future. Yet one of the state's own systems, one central to our right of self-governance, remains hopelessly analog. Texas is one of about 10 states without an online voter registration system, a baffling anachronism that was back in the headlines and the federal courts last week. As the Statesman's Chuck Lindell reported, Texans can easily renew their driver's licenses online, but if they want to register to vote or update their registration from one county to another, they must print out a paper form and mail it to their county registrar. U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia ruled last week those extra steps put Texas in violation of the 1993 Motor Voter Law, which was intended to make voter registration easier. Lawyers for the Texas Civil Rights Project, which filed the lawsuit, have estimated those difficulties cost more than 735 Texans the right to vote in 2018. The state's track record on this issue has been to fight the litigation and shun the actual solution of developing an online voter registration system. That needs to stop. It's foolish for Texas to cling to a paper system that's bound to be less accurate, less accessible to applicants, and more expensive to administer than an online one. State Representative Celia Israel, a Democrat from Austin, has pushed bills in the last three sessions with dozens of co-sponsors to launch an online voter registration system, but each time the effort has died in committee. Quote, "It's embarrassing that so many states have it and Texas doesn't," she lamented in 2018. It's not just a matter of convenience for voters, although that is important. The paper-based system is costly and labor-intensive for registrars' offices. Staffers must examine the forms by hand, decipher an applicant's handwriting, and enter the information into their computer system. On the last day to register before the November 2018 election, the Travis County Tax Office received about 40,000 voter registration applications, voter registrar Bruce Alphen told us. An army of employees and temps worked long hours and through the weekend to process those applications, finishing the last batch on the third day of early voting. Thinking back to that mountain of paperwork, Alphen asks, what business would operate like this? Much of that burden would be lifted if applicants entered the information themselves online. Registrars would deal with fewer incomplete paper applications that must be sent back, as an online system would require certain fields to be filled out before the form can go through. Those efficiencies would translate into real savings from local government offices. A 2010 study found that Arizona, the first state to provide online voter registration, saw administrative costs drop from 83 cents per paper registration to 3 cents per online registration. It would also eliminate the chance for mistakes as staffers enter the information from paper forms. Another Arizona study found voter registrations from paper forms were up to 5 times more likely to have errors than registrations filed online. If there's a silver lining to Texas dragging its feet on online voter registration, it's the fact that other states have done the hard work to develop secure systems that Texas could replicate. To verify the voter's identity, an online application could require a driver's license number or the last 4 digits of a person's Social Security number, data that could easily be checked against other state records. Other security features are available to guard against hackers. Even with an online voter registration system, paper applications would remain available. But Elfont estimates about half of those registering to vote in Travis County would do so online, which would translate into significant savings. Many of us already handle our banking and pay our bills online. When it's time to pay our property tax bills, or renew our driver's licenses, or request a copy of a birth certificate, Texas has online systems that are up to the task. Surely a new tech mecca can figure out how to do the same thing with voter registration. This is the medical advice column, To Your Good Health, by Dr. Keith Roach. Dear Dr. Roach, I'm 53 and perimenopausal. I've been very emotional. I don't want to cry about every little thing. It's embarrassing. What do you suggest? Answer. Mood lability, ups and downs, are very common in women in early menopause. Mood symptoms are effectively treated with hormone replacement, but not everyone needs it. However, particularly with women with depression, hormone therapy can be very effective when combined with an antidepressant. I do not recommend medication treatment lightly, but depression is a condition I take very seriously. Since the incidence of depression is high during the time of menopause, I discuss the risks and benefits of hormonal therapy, sometimes along with antidepressant medication. Many women are able to taper off treatment in a year. The risks of hormone treatment for a year are small, but still need to be discussed. This is Ticket, Weekend Entertainment Guide for the Permian Basin. The Ellen Noel Art Museum at 4909 East University Boulevard continues the exhibit Sacred Scripts, 1,000 Years of Religious Texts. Visit noelartmuseum.org for more information. The Permian Playhouse's first show of 2020 will be Little Shop of Horrors from February 21st to March 1st. Visit permianplayhouse.com for more on the show and the 2020 season at the theater. Shrimp Fest, a benefit for the Ellen Noel Art Museum, is scheduled February 24th at the Ector County Coliseum. Enjoy a Cajun-style celebration with unlimited shrimp, music, and auction. General admission includes food and two drink tickets. Sponsor tables are also available. For more information, call the museum at 432-550-9696 or visit noelartmuseum.org. Concert showcases West Texas winds. The Midland-Odessa Symphony and Chorale will showcase the West Texas winds during a Sunday afternoon concert in Midland. The show is scheduled at 3 p.m. Sunday at First United Methodist Church in Midland. The event will feature Wind Quintet in B Dur, Opus 56, No. 1, by Franz Danzy, also Quintet No. 1 by Jean Francais, and Quintet No. 1 for Winds in D Major, Opus 124, by Giulio Bricaldi. The event features $15 general admission tickets, and students are admitted free. The group features Melissa Graham Hansen on flute. Hansen is the principal flutist with the MOSC and with the Winds. The MOSC website details that after joining the MOSC as a flutist in 2012, she also served as an orchestra representative on the MOSC board from 2013 to 2014, and as an MOSC personnel manager, 2014 to present. She has served as a faculty member at the University of Texas Permian Basin and Odessa College, and has taught private students of all ages since 1998. Karen Crutchfield on oboe. Crutchfield is now in her 23rd season with the MOSC. She performs regularly as a member of the West Texas Winds Woodwind Quintet and teaches at the University of Texas Permian Basin, Odessa College, and the West Texas A&M Band Camp. She also teaches private lessons to students throughout the Permian Basin and has a thriving reed-making business. Chris Chance, clarinet. Chance has performed with orchestras across the United States and is currently principal clarinet of the Midland-Odessa Symphony, principal clarinet of the Missouri Symphony Orchestra, and clarinetist of the West Texas Winds Woodwind Quintet. In addition to live performance, he has also worked as a recording studio musician for the Hal Leonard Corporation. Sonia Millichamp on horn. Prior to moving to West Texas, she spent 6 years as the horn professor at Millikan University in Decatur, Illinois, where she also performed with the faculty woodwind quintet and served as principal horn of the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra. Philip Hill on bassoon. Hill is in his third season with the MOSC as principal bassoon. He is an adjunct faculty member of the University of Texas Permian Basin and recently was an artist resident at the University of Idaho. He also holds a private bassoon studio in the Midland-Odessa area. No instruments needed for this show. A cappella live on stage at Wagner. A cappella is more of a worldwide phenomenon than simply just a popular sound. With the success of everything from High School Musical to Pitch Perfect, the sound draws in audiences of all ages. The Columbia Artists touring show, A Cappella Live, is scheduled at 7:30 p.m. February 12th at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. The show features a number of groups who are award winners and talent show champs. Committed is a Nashville-based award-winning musical group of five men. They emerged as the Season 2 champions of NBC's hit musical competition, The Sing-Off, which reached 9 million viewers weekly. Their press materials detail that they released a self-titled album and a Christmas EP, which was nominated for a Grammy, Dove, Stellar, and NAACP Image Award. Dennis Batiste, Justin Pierre, Maurice Staple, Robert Presley, and Theron Thomas have traveled the world sharing their harmonies, teaching workshops, and using their influence to make an impact in various communities. The Philharmonic is based in Los Angeles and is an a cappella group of Filipino-Americans who were featured in NBC's hit musical competition, The Sing-Off. The five-piece vocal group made the semifinals, joined the Sing-Off National Tour, and were featured in the Universal Pictures hit movie Pitch Perfect 2, then became a viral sensation after their Late Late Show appearances. In 2016, the Philharmonic brought their blend of hip-hop, pop, and 90s nostalgia to more than 150 stages nationwide. The group includes Vijay Rosales, Joe Cadjoy, Trace Gaynor, Jules Cruz, and Nico Del Rey. Blake Lewis first came to national attention while competing on American Idol, and long before that, as a teenager, he was well known as B. Shorty in Seattle's a cappella, hip-hop, and rave scenes. Women of the World was formed to bring women musicians from across the globe onto a common platform to collaborate and create through sharing of music, to explore and celebrate the differences in ideologies and cultural tenets that exist in the daily lives of women all over the world. Ayumi Uda, a Berklee College of Music alumna from Japan, sought to create a multicultural. She joined with Giorgia Renosto from Italy, Annette Philip from India, Debo Ray from the United States and Haiti. Here are some obituaries and death notices that appeared in the Odessa American on Friday, February 7th. William J. Bill Brock passed away quietly and suddenly on Saturday, January 18th, at the age of 96. The son of A.C. and Cynthia Brock, Bill was married to Martha for the 70 years prior to her passing in 2016. Martha and Bill had two children, Cindy and John. Over the years, his descendants grew to include five grandchildren and for great-grandchildren. A memorial service will be held at Prairie Haven Cemetery in Hobbs, New Mexico, at 12:30 p.m. on Saturday, February 8th. Minnie Marie Steinman Gummelt, age 96, passed away February 3rd at Medical City Hospital in Weatherford, Texas. Minnie, known as Marie by her family and friends, was born February 2nd, 1924, to Wilhelmine Becker Steinman and Willie Lewis Steinman of Pretty, Texas, in Mills County. On October 14, 1944, Marie married Earl Wayne Gummelt of Starr, Texas, in Hamilton County. They were married in Goldthwaite, Texas. Earl was the love of her life. They were devoted to each other for more than 67 years. Marie is survived by her daughters, Doris Stewart and husband Isaiah Spikes of Houston, and Betty Patterson and husband Larry of Weatherford, a son, Gerald Gummelt, and wife Amber of Houston. She is also survived by 7 grandchildren. She is survived by 18 great-grandchildren and 3 great-great-grandchildren. She is also survived by 4 sisters and 1 brother, Dora Lipp of Marble Falls, Rosa Hall of Burnett, Dorothy Caudill of Wake Village, Benjamin Steinman and wife Joyce of Clovis, New Mexico, and Mary Sider and husband Otto of The Woodlands. Services will be held Friday, February 7th at 10 a.m. at Galbraith Pickard Funeral Home in Weatherford, Texas, with a family gathering following. A graveside service will be held Saturday, February 8th, at Sunset Memorial Gardens in Odessa. David Scott Harris, beloved husband and father, lost his long and very hard-fought battle with cancer on Tuesday, February 4th, at the age of 64. David was born on April 13th, 1955, in Houston, Texas, to Pete and Frankie Harris. David is survived by his wife, Anita, of 42 years, son, Austin Harris, and wife, Amber, of Odessa, Holly Barron and husband, Nate, of Round Rock, brothers, Doug Harris and wife, Marcia, and Don Harris, of Corpus Christi, grandchildren, Hunter, Inara, Tyler, Charlie, Brady, and Landry, mother-in-law, Vicki Simpson, and sister-in-law Julie Goodson of Georgetown, nieces Delaney Story, Darby Goodson, Kelly Frazee, and nephew Clint Harris and families. Visitation will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. on Friday, February 7th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held at 4 p.m. on Saturday, February 8th, at Stonegate Fellowship in Odessa, with Randy Unruh officiating. To send family condolences, please sign his guestbook at www.sunsetodessa.com. Michael Edwin Bradley, age 66, died Monday, February 3rd, in Odessa. Services are pending with Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Ruby Joyce Bryant, age 85, of Odessa, died Sunday, February 2nd, in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. February 7th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home Chapel. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Reverend Dr. Jimmy Braswell is officiating. Naomi Maxine Cravens Guthrie, age 84, died Wednesday, February 5th, in Midland. Services are pending with Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. William David Morris, age 59, died Thursday, February 6th, in Odessa. Services are pending with Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Donald Ray Royce, age 81, of Odessa, died Sunday, February 2nd, in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. February 8th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home Chapel. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Reverend Lindell Lee is officiating. Census to put official numbers on Midland's growth. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. The population inside Midland County was estimated at 173,576 in 2017, and it was thought that Hispanics would make up 52% of the population in 2020. That is what the U.S. Census Bureau is estimating this census year, said Bureau Senior Partnership Specialist Charlene Romero-McBride. Quote, I think that is 20,000 short, McBride said, of the total population. She told the Midland Republican National Hispanic Assembly last week that she expects Hispanics will make up 58% of the population. McBride, who is involved in the effort to count population in 13 counties in West Texas, said the number one goal is to ensure an accurate count, no matter the population or demography outcome. Quote, where you live, 51% of the time is where you are counted, McBride said. Last year, the U.S. Census Bureau estimated Midland's growth from 2010 to 2018 was 25.9%. That ranked Midland's metropolitan area as the fourth fastest-growing community in the nation. McBride told those in attendance that the U.S. Constitution requires the counting of every resident and that the census matters because it is used in the drawing of congressional and state legislative districts, in the distribution of $675 billion annually, and in the planning for government, businesses, and nonprofits. McBride said that for the first time, residents will be able to use the Internet to participate in the once-a-decade count. Online is one of four ways to respond, she said. The other are by phone, by mail, or in person. She also said that an educational campaign is underway to change the mindset of those who might not want to participate in the census process. She said a study of barriers, attitudes, and motivators showed there were issues with apathy and efficacy, privacy concerns, fear of repercussions, distrust in government, and few perceived personal benefits. She said the process has been slimmed down to 9 questions and information is kept confidential. The Census Bureau states it will never even share a respondent's personal information with other government agencies, and wrongful disclosure can result in prison time and/or a fine. Quote, we're not talking about taking people away from our communities, McBride said. The census process is set to move from its promotion phase to its motivation action phase, also described as a call to action for residents to respond. The motivation action phase is expected to last from February through June. In March, the self-response part of the collection process will start. Non-response follow-ups will begin in May. The data collection is expected to be completed in August, according to the Census Bureau. Midland County demographics. 2010 population, 138,000. 2017 estimated population, 173,000. 2010 Hispanic population, 45.3%. 2020 Hispanic population estimate, 52%. Source, U.S. Census Bureau. Did you know? The first census started in 1790. It took 2.5 years to complete, and U.S. Marshals conducted the count, according to Charlene Romero-McBride, Senior Partnership Specialist for the Census Bureau. Jobs are available in the 2020 census collection process. Applicants must be at least 18, Salary is up to $24.50 an hour, and mileage is paid at a rate of 58 cents a mile. To apply, go to 2020census.gov/jobs. Nuclear waste storage could continue in Carlsbad. DOE seeks to renew permit for waste isolation pilot plant. The story was written by Adrian Hedden of the Carlsbad Current Argus newspaper. Nuclear waste could continue to be buried beneath Carlsbad for another 32 years if the New Mexico Environment Department approves a permit renewal filed for the waste isolation pilot plant by the U.S. Department of Energy and contractor Nuclear Waste Partnership. The 10-year renewal did not entail any changes to the process of accepting transuranic waste, mostly radiated clothing items or machine parts, or emplacing it in the underground salt formations about 2,000 feet below the surface. It did not seek to increase WIPP's capacity or make changes to three areas permitted to hold waste: a parking area where waste is held before being brought into the WIPP, the waste handling building within the facility, and the underground salt mine where it is permanently disposed. The renewal application did seek to alter the final date of emplacement, as defined in the permit, from 2024 to 2052, adding 28 years to WIPP lifetime. Karen Day, a permitting manager with NWP, said the contractor and DOE would file subsequent permit modification requests as more space is needed. She presented the renewal application to public stakeholders during a Thursday meeting at the DOE's Skeen Whitlock Building in Carlsbad. It was the second public hearing on the matter, with the first held January 23rd in Santa Fe. Representatives from the City of Carlsbad and other local agencies spoke in support of the renewal. No opposition was voiced during the meeting. WIPP holds TRU waste in 8 panels, with waste being emplaced in Panel 7 as Panel 8 is being mined. Panel 8 was expected to be fully mined by 2020. Mining of Panel 8 started in 2013, but was interrupted after an accidental radiological release in the underground due to an improperly packaged drum of waste led to a 3-year halt of WIPP's primary operations. The south end of the mine was recently closed, allowing no more waste to be added to the area after a rock fall. By the year 2024, Day said that WIPP would be accepting 17 shipments per week with 40 shipping weeks each year. Quote, "The assumption is that future panels will be needed. The permittees will request additional permit modifications in the future for those additional panels," Day said. Continuing the quote, "The permittees are proposing no changes to the permitted units. They have indicated that there are no significant changes in this renewal application," end quote. At the meeting, Carlsbad Mayor Dale Janway touted the economic benefit he said WIPP brought to Carlsbad since it opened in 1999. He said the city supported the renewal and WIPP's role in national defense. Quote, "WIPP provides stable, good-paying jobs," Janway said. "We also believe it is vitally important to keep this process moving along. There's still tens of thousands of cubic meters of waste that will need to be sent to WIPP for several decades. WIPP is a modernized facility that should serve the nation for as long as it is needed. We're proud of the important role we play in national security," end quote. Norbert Rempe, a retired geologist and former WIPP employee, questioned the permit renewal as providing no plan for where waste would be emplaced after panels 7 and 8 are filled. Quote, "It is my understanding that this renewal application is looking forward, not backward. When the first permit was received from the state, we had a picture similar to this one," he said, while indicating a map of the WIP underground displayed during the meeting. "Now we want to extend it until 2052, and we have no picture of what is going to happen. The public has no idea what is to happen in the next 10 years or 32. If WIP is saying it is communicating with the public on what will happen in the future, then this is insufficient," end quote. Larry Mitchell, vice president of the Carlsbad Department of Development's Board of Directors, said the final emplacement date was arbitrary and extending it was a mere technicality, as TRU waste was continually being generated during nuclear research and other activities. He said WIP should continue to be used to dispose of TRU waste for as long as needed. Quote, "Our community knows that this date was always arbitrary," Mitchell said. "There is TRU waste being generated that should go to WIP. It makes sense to put a proven facility that has been modernized and has a highly trained workforce to good use," end quote. Mitchell warned that if WIP activities were ceased in the coming years, nuclear waste could build up at generator sites, often near high population areas or bodies of water. Quote, "I assumed those that live near the generators in northern New Mexico would certainly agree with this logic rather than allowing TRU waste to be stockpiled," Mitchell said. "We know that WIP continues to responsively serve as a permanent solution to the nation's TRU waste created by the nation's defense programs. We believe it would be foolish to set an arbitrary date limit," end quote. Scott Kovac, Operations and Research Director at Nuclear Watch New Mexico, a Santa Fe-based nuclear watchdog group, argued that the public agreed to a specific amount of waste and a time limit on operations before WIP was opened. He cautioned that national laboratories would soon begin increasing plutonium pit production, which could result in more TRU waste being generated, and request to extend WIP operations even beyond 2052. Quote, "It's very likely that it could go on much longer than that," Kovac said. "The extension of the date needs to be discussed thoroughly. We need to slow down and look at what the implications could be," end quote. Kovac said the DOE should be figuring out what to do with TRU waste after WIP is closed, and that the need for more time to emplace the waste in the permitted space was due to inefficient packing during past operations. Quote, "We'd feel a lot better if they were working on what happens after WIP," he said. "That doesn't seem to come up. They were very inefficient in emplacing the waste. Because of DOE's inefficiency, New Mexico is getting straddled with a longer opening of WIP," end quote. If WIP is kept open longer, Kovac worried it could become a repository for more than low-level TRU waste. Quote, "WIP is the only real hole in the ground for radioactive waste," he said. "The longer it stays open, the more chances are they'll try to bring more types of waste," end quote. Doctor says, to feel safe, people need to know they're important. Midland Independent School District hosts 5th Annual Mental Health Conference. The story was written by Caitlin Randall. Midland ISD hosted its 5th Annual Mental Health Conference on Friday for school counselors, educators, and others who work with children. This year's conference centered around the polyvagal theory, which focuses on how the nervous system connects to social engagement, said Joelle Bracken, MISD's Student Behavioral Support Coordinator. Quote, "It's really interesting and it's really helpful," she said. "So we thought it would be helpful to our counselors," end quote. Dr. George Thompson was the keynote speaker at this year's event. Thompson is an expert in polyvagal theory and chief medical officer of a child behavioral health agency in Kansas City. He spoke about the three different states of the brain, which he described as safety, danger, and life threat. He says a person needs to feel safe for their brain to work properly and for them to display correct behaviors. Quote, "A nervous system that's focused on danger can't focus on solutions," he said. "It first needs to know that it's safe," end quote. Thompson said the main way counselors and educators can make patients and students feel safe is by demonstrating that they care about the other's experiences. They can do this by showing patients or students that they're important, he said. He also spoke about children in the community who might be traumatized after the August shootings in Midland and Odessa. Quote, "If a dangerous thing happens to a group of people, we have to be more deliberate about connecting," he said. "To help people heal from trauma, they must see that their experience matters and they're not alone in their experience," he said. "The rise of technology presents a challenge for those who work with children," he said. He said people are often disconnected from face-to-face communication, but face-to-face communication is what conveys signals of safety to others. After the keynote speech, there were training sessions on topics such as connecting with others, improving marriages, and working with children who have experienced traumas, Bracken said. She said one goal of the conference was to connect different service providers in the area who may need to collaborate in the future. Quote, "Sometimes it takes more than one agency to best serve a student or a family," she said. "So we want those people meeting each other so that they can connect," end quote. The other goal, Bracken said, is to keep counselors current with what they've been trained in. Quote, "This field is constantly changing, so our counselors need to be up to date on their skills and their knowledge so they can best serve kids," she said. This is the medical advice column, To Your Good Health, by Dr. Keith Roach. "Dear Dr. Roach, my brother is 65 years old and was spitting up when eating. He went for an endoscopy yesterday and was diagnosed with grade 3 esophagitis. He has been drinking 5 glasses of wine daily for years. Did this cause his problem? He said he will stop drinking wine and drink some other, less acidic alcohol. What is esophagitis, and what can he do to get better?" Answer. Esophagitis is an inflammation of the esophagus, which has many possible causes. The most likely cause, just from total numbers, is reflux esophagitis. That is caused by stomach contents and acid going backward from the stomach into the esophagus. The acid causes chemical damage to the esophagus. The fact that your brother has been spitting up, that is, having food contents coming all the way back to the mouth, is strong evidence of esophageal reflux. 5 glasses of wine a day is too much for many body systems. He needs to reduce his drinking for his health. I suspect reducing alcohol will help his esophagitis, but it is critical for many other organs, including the liver, brain, bone marrow, and heart.
That's all for today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, a production of the Recording Library of West Texas. You can also hear this program anytime online at recordinglibrary.org or by calling the telephone reader at 432-617-5555.